How do people find themselves walking down that path?
I think it's hard to say that there's like one path.
What is the relationship of everything that we've been talking about to psilocybin and psychedelics?
Well, I think these plants have this kind of magical ability to give us a new perspective.
My job is so overwhelming. How am I even going to find time to do the work on this?
Psychedelics are powerful and they should be used with reverence. I don't feel like I'm living more with more trust, openness, joy. It's tough to relive hard things that's happened to us.
Those who are being difficult are coming from pain can help us be more of that compassionate person doing great stuff in the world, just like you, Neil. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Webdelics Podcast, where we're on a journey to find out the truth about psychedelics and plant medicine. Get rid of the myths and change the narrative. I'm your host, Scott Mason, and with us today is an extraordinary guest, Neil Markey. Neil, tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, thanks for having me on, Scott. I appreciate it. I'm a soldier. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm an uncle. And I'm a seeker.
I love it. That gives us a lot to explore as we get deeper and deeper into the topic of this episode. But before we even discuss what that topic is, Neil, let me give you a heartfelt welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Scott.
We're ecstatic. The theme of today's episode is the end of elitism, breaking down doors with psilocybin. Now, Neil, when you briefly introduced yourself earlier, you gave a very high-level and understated description of your career. Even just listening to what you said earlier, I could tell that your background is extraordinarily diverse. But one of the things that I find so likable about you, and I'm sure the audience will as well, is that you're actually quite humble. I'm gonna bust out the truth about you, okay? Yes, you were an Army Ranger, and yes, you are a seeker, and we're gonna talk about seeking what and all the other stuff that you mentioned, but you have an MBA from Columbia University, homeboy, and you worked for McKinsey, and you have a background in private equity. These are impressive accomplishments at a very elite level where you're dealing with and surrounded by the wealthiest, most powerful people in the world all the time. So I've got to start by asking, Neil, what on earth do you have? What do you know about elitism? And by the way, is elitism really such a problem? Talk to us about that for a second.
I'm fortunate that I had the opportunity to have some of those life experiences that you mentioned. I come from a lower middle class family in Frederick, Maryland. My dad was an artist and my mom was a full-time mom. And I sometimes have to pinch myself that I feel like I found my way into the back door of some of those institutions that you mentioned. And look, there's amazing people in those organizations. And most of them are just trying to, you know, be happy and do good things in their lives. And then, you know, to the second part of your question, is there a problem with the elitism? I mean, yeah, there is, you know, and sometimes having a lot of material things and a lot of power can actually, in some ways, prevent you from being happy and connected. But most people are just out there trying to do their best, you know, just sometimes it's misdirected.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, though, how the culture that can accompany elitism can keep people from being happy, even if they're trying to be happy and do their best. I'm going to step back a little bit. I'm so glad you shared a sentence or two about your background, because you and I actually have a little bit more in common than I raised when I described you for yourself a few minutes ago. For instance, we both went to Columbia University. While you were in getting your MBA, I was practicing law using the law degree that I got from Columbia University. And like you, I came from very humble beginnings. My mom worked for a dog food factory. That's not glamorous at all. And my father worked for the State Highway Patrol. And when I went to an elite institution like you, I kind of was not sure how exactly I got there. It was a big cultural adjustment. And I found myself sometimes a little bit resentful or irritated by those, particularly as I move forward in my career with that degree, who were talking about being miserable, who were talking about being happy, because I thought about the people that I grew up with, right? Like the trucker next door, the people who worked for the Pepsi plant. They were happy just to be able to survive. In their mind, I imagined them hearing things like what you just said or what I might have seen in my career and saying, rich people problems, who cares? What would you say to folks like that?
I mean, everyone has their story, you know, and I think it's not so helpful to try and like compare sometimes people's trauma to other folks' trauma. But there's a lot of unhappiness in these wealthy communities too. You know, I mean, so I think what, you know, what we're hoping to do, like with this work that we're doing, is just remind folks of the humanity in everyone, you know, and everybody's got challenges. That's what being human is, you know, and having empathy for people, regardless of what their background is. You know, my parents in the same way, because they didn't have a lot of material things, that, you know, we almost put people that had wealth in, you know, we almost, you know, thought that they were bad people because they were wealthy. I don't think that's helpful either. You know, that's, you know, us versus them type of mentality. And I think what we want is to break that down and let people see that, you know, we are all the same. We all want the same things.
It does, though, in a backward sort of way, point us to a fundamental issue with elitism and a culture that promotes elitism, even if there is a meritocratic element to it, which is that elitism, or the perception that some people have more than others, creates division. When I first got into Columbia Law School, so I am biracial. I went to an African-American church, and no one in that church could conceive of someone, maybe they could conceive of someone going to a law school, but certainly not to New York City, to Columbia University. I mean, people like didn't know how to react, but I got a lot of, it's a very elite institution. It's a very elite institution. And I felt in a way like they were implying by walking through the gates of that institution, I was leaving them behind, which of course is never what I'm about. But people celebrate when you're at these institutions. You're separate from the rest of the world. You're not ordinary. You are going to have more in your life. You've been given more through your brains or your ability or these other things that other people don't have. It's not like at Ivy League institutions they're sitting to their students and saying, okay, now just go and be an ordinary, regular person, because that's what you are. They don't say that. You've just paid so much money to be in the doggone place. They're never going to say that. Thinking about then that, do you believe that the separation, well, do you agree that elitism can bring about this sense of separation? And if so, what do you see that as creating within those that are being separated through those institutional systems?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think that there's something beautiful in this like pursuit of greatness, you know, and like being the best version of yourself that you can be. And there are some, you know, companies and institutions out there that are great, you know, and they give you a lot, you know, they train you, they connect you to different networks and expose you to different ways of thinking. And that's all positive. I think it's then like through, like, what do you become through that, you know? And I think there's some danger of going into those communities. And then, like you said, you actually, then you think that you're different than everyone else and you're more special than everyone else. And now you're more elite than everyone else and you deserve more than everyone else because you've gotten the opportunity to do these things. And I think that if that mindset change, you know, creates more separateness, then that's where there's a lot of risk of becoming pretty unhappy, like long term. But if you use those experiences to build your resume and, you know, have more opportunities, but then you see the reality, which is we're all in this thing together. You know, we are all part of the same natural ecosystem of humanity. And you use those experiences to try and help others, help the planet, help nature, then you're going to have this, you know, internal feeling of contentment and happiness that we're all ultimately seeking. But if you go into those communities and now you're better than everyone else and you're just going to, you know, maximize your own material wealth, that is probably not the best, like, long-term strategy to contentment and happiness. That's actually just another kind of addictive tendency that a lot of the Western world, unfortunately, has gone down.
Neil, based on your experience, observation, whether it's you or those around you, how do people find themselves walking down that path? What makes them become that person, assuming they didn't set out to be that person?
Well, you know, we're part of our environments, and so we get feedback from our environments. And just like if you're a fish and if you're swimming in water that is not well or not healthy water, then it's going to impact you. And so if you're in a toxic work environment where folks are, you know, more worried about near-term financial gains than they are about other human beings or the planet, that's going to affect you over time, whether you're aware of it or not. And, you know, I think that, again, most people, almost everyone is just trying to be happy, you know. It's that we sometimes get a little bit off track and what we think is actually, like, what's going to actually do that for us. And I think we've been conditioned in our society to think it's more material things. That's just kind of like the American dream is more stuff, more material things, more kind of like ego-centered things. And we just know from research, and I think a lot of us know this intuitively, it's up to a certain point, happiness is correlated with income. Past a certain point, at best, it's not correlated. It actually looks like in many cases, it's negatively correlated. So what happens in these elite communities where they're well past that kind of like basic needs met is they're just spending too much of their time and efforts and conscious awareness on material things. And that just doesn't fill us up. What we need is connection with other human beings and connection with nature. That's what makes us feel good. That, like, because we're part of this. But, you know, the material path is a really alluring, you know, it's got a lot of shiny objects. But I mean, we know this. It's all those material things, at best, they're kind of like a little temporary dopamine hit. But then we just adjust to that. What really brings this idea of like peace and contentment is your personal relationships, you know, and your spiritual practices. And do you feel connected on a daily basis? Do you feel like you have some purpose that's more than just more things? You know, that's what makes us happy. It's just many of us have been kind of conditioned to think in one direction, and we need to kind of open that up a bit.
Is this something that you yourself felt when you were in that world? I mean, I know when I was career climbing, I did. It's almost like after a while, I just assumed that my lot in life was to be unhappy, and I just sort of shrugged, accepted it, and then just strived for more of the material things or the prestige or all that sort of stuff. I didn't really stop to think, maybe my lot isn't to be unhappy. Did you experience anything like that at all?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think it's hard to say that there's like one path for anyone. Everybody's so different. I think it's trying to help people do the work and find the practices so they can kind of tune into what's inside and then let that lead. And what I mean by that is I think that not everybody in this lifetime is going to find like their life's purpose and work. And I think that's okay, you know? It's but are you doing something, you know, if you're not purpose driven, if work is more just a means to an end to have some financial stability, but you're super passionate about being an amazing father and member of the community, and you find something like outside of work that really lights you up and you feel like is good for the collective, I think there's balance to be had there. Where I think it gets really toxic is you're in these jobs that are all consuming and they're just not a fit for you personally. You don't really believe in what the company's doing at a high level, or at least like your heart doesn't, even if your conscious mind's not aware of it. And then you don't even have any hours outside of that to devote to something that's meaningful. And then you're just going to get smoked. I mean, that's when you just get burned out and miserable. And yeah, that was me, you know, that definitely. I had a block of rock bottom when I came out of the service, and then I had like another rock bottom in my corporate years. So, yes.
First of all, I'm sorry to hear about the service rock bottom, and we'll talk about making it through these rock bottoms and the relationship of psilocybin magic mushrooms to them. But let's talk a little bit about your rock bottom. You know, one of the things that I have found, again, with people that I know that went from institutions like Columbia, and it's not the only one, so I don't want to just point a finger at that one. Like you said, a lot of the professional cultures that you go into, McKinsey is, by its reputation, an incredible example of that, but big law or major accounting firms or even high-level corporate sorts of jobs, that all-consuming nature, it's like there is part of what you wear as a badge of pride is how hard you're willing to work. And there's almost an expectation that if you do have work-life balance, or if you're not willing to be there 18 hours a day, and I'm not exaggerating, 7 days a week, and to sacrifice your holidays, then you're really not committed and you're not worthy and you're not going to move up. And you can't see out of it because you are in that world. It becomes like this bubble that it's completely opaque. There's no way you can see out of it. How did that, and it did it, impact your rock bottom when it came to your corporate and professional life?
Yeah, I think I have an interesting kind of relationship with my experience, because in some ways I'm so grateful for them because they allow me to do what I'm doing now, and I think I learned a lot from them and they left some marks on me. So it's like one of these things, like many experiences in life, it's not all good, it's not all bad, it's kind of this mix, and it's more about what you do with it after the fact. I had a friend that was leading a team at a consultancy, we'll let it be unnamed, that was working for a very large company that sold consumer packaged goods, mostly cheese. And the company's been around for forever. And, you know, elite consultancy, they mostly work for Fortune 100, 200 companies. They were, you know, looking for ways to essentially sell more cheese, right? Not super inspiring or kind of like, you know, mission critical problem, right? We're selling more cheese. One of the associates on the team, though, was under so much pressure from the project and just like pressure they put on themselves to perform, he started going blind in his left eye. This is to me, I mean, it's just like, what are we doing? But it's these environments that we create. It's these like super high performers, And then we put them all together. And then it's almost this frantic pursuit of sometimes things that aren't even that important. And we make ourselves sick, you know? And I mean, that's happening everywhere. And I would just, you know, it's like, you deserve better than that, you know, find something. And there's, the world's huge. There's so many opportunities out there where I think you can have financial stability, which is fair, I think, a fair desire. And, you know, I think some of these high performers, they want something to pour their heart into. They want to work hard. There's a lot of satisfaction in working hard, but just like, do it on something that like you feel proud about, you'd want to tell your grandkids about, you know, and you deserve that. And just like, don't limit yourself to thinking kind of in these, you know, that there's only like a few firms or companies or whatever where you're able to, you know, to have a career that's meaningful, you know, like you can have your cake and eat it too.
Neil, what is the relationship of everything that we've been talking about to psilocybin and psychedelics?
Well, I think these plants have this kind of magical ability to give us a new perspective. And I think that, you know, if many of us, you get to, you know, you kind of get, you grow up, you kind of get conditioned through school and through our existing environments. And then next thing you know, especially if you're a high performer, you're kind of you're on this treadmill and you're running real fast. And you don't literally sometimes have the mental bandwidth in your mind, the space in your mind or the space in your day to kind of try and like zoom out and look at yourself objectively and say, am I living right? Or is this really what I should be doing? Because you're so consumed. And you can do this if you ask people, you read some of these studies or some of these projects that have been done around people in the late stages of their life and what they regret or whatever. You can do this mode for decades. So like be careful, you know, like it'll go by. I just had my 10-year grad school reunion. It's like, whoa, we're 10 years. And what I think psychedelics, psilocybin, mushrooms can do is they can give people an experience that allows for that objective perspective of their life. And then this new self, with this new self-awareness, then you can have change. But if you're so in it, you know, you kind of can't see the forest for the trees, then you don't know how to maneuver it because you're just in this autopilot mode. And so that's why I think that there's so much potential in these experiences to help people kind of tune into what's actually going on in their life and then be able to make some adjustments.
How did you discover this? Tell us a story we have to know.
Well, so I was in the service in my, I joined after 9/11. I thought I was doing the right thing. I found out later that, you know, this whole weapons of mass destruction thing was not exactly accurate. And it kind of was a complete shit show. And I got out in 2012, so 12 years ago, and I was at Columbia University. And so by some measures, doing very well professionally on paper, right? I was at prestigious school. That first year, I was getting job offers at prestigious companies. And so there was that side of me. I was showing up well, and I was miserable. I was going through a divorce. I was isolating. I was using alcohol. I mean, I was having some really dark days that not many people were aware of at all. I'm fortunate, you know, I mean, and well, this is the insight for me too, is there is a lot of people out there that are showing up that are in a tremendous amount of pain. And a lot of times we don't know. And so for me, it's like, okay, what's empathy? Well, you know, empathy is easy if you're having empathy for people that are like, you know, being easy on you. The real empathy is for those folks that are showing up and are a little bit more irritable or, you know, and it's because there's most times pain there. There's pain or fear. And so that's, you know, that's something I'm working on. But I hit this kind of rock bottom and I just wanted to feel better. You know, I mean, I didn't want to be around anymore. And I got introduced to meditation. And I kind of stumbled into this meditation program. And then for me, it was just right on time. It was just exactly what I needed. And it was different enough from the kind of established Western stuff that I kind of like thought felt like bullshit, honestly. And it just felt right. And I got really deep into meditation. And then I had some professionally facilitated psychedelic experiences in those years. And for me, and I still really believe this, it felt like those experiences were accelerating what I was trying to do with meditation, or making it more impactful. And so, yeah, well, in that, I love that, the Rumi, the Sufi poet, he's got that, there's a quote or whatever, that's like, when you're on your knees is a good time to pray. You know, it's like when life humbles you and like knocks you down, like there's clarity in that. And then, you know, I got through that kind of like, you know, challenging period. I got introduced to some of these tools that have fundamentally changed and improved my life, you know?
Now, if I were to use these tools, and I have used these tools, but I'm sort of speaking as someone who is listening who might be feeling similarly to you are. Maybe they're working for some massive law firm, or maybe they are working for a consulting agency or a cheese company of some sort, or milk or whatever, and they're just overwhelmed and, oh my God, heaven forbid, they wake up one morning and they're starting to go blind, and it's purely because of stress. That's just an unbelievable story. What might you tell them then that psychedelics can offer? Or perhaps if they're scared to leave what they're doing behind, what comfort can you provide them that this could be a positive experience, and how can they, walking into it, do what they need to in order to make it a positive experience?
Well, I think that, you know, psychedelics are powerful and they should be used with reverence, you know? And so, and I think, you know, the way in which they're used is really was one of the most important things. Some of the psychonauts from history would say that the actual compound is less than 50% of the experience. It's more the where, the how, the why, the who, you know, like the set and the setting, all of the things that wrap around it are as equal, if not more important than the compound. But if you look at mushrooms, for instance, I mean, they've been used for thousands of years. And some of these communities, without pause. And they also, we know that they've been used, you know, recreationally in contemporary cultures for a long time. And, you know, there's just lots of data points out there to say that if they're used in the right way, that the risk is relatively low. You know, they're, from a pharmacological perspective, you know, they're non-toxic, they're non-addictive. It looks like they're neuroregenerative, so they actually improve the health of the brain. Now, where you got to be super cautious is that set and setting, and this is where people, you know, this is where the important thing is they're so powerful that if you take them and you kind of don't do it in the right way, and then next thing you know, you're in a setting that's not the right setting for it. It can be traumatic. It can be scary because your entire world will shift. And if you're just not in the place that feels safe and not with people that kind of know what they're doing, then it can be a traumatic experience. But if you, you know, do all the right things and, you know, make sure you have proper screening and you teach people the skills to how to navigate the experience, you do it in a safe setting. That's, you know, I'm a big proponent of, you know, more nature-based kind of set and setting. You have trained facilitators, then you can pretty much eliminate this traumatic experience potential. With that said, many people have challenging experiences, but like challenge is good if it's in a right amount. What we just want, we want to not have it traumatic, but many people have experiences where like, whoa, that was a lot. But through that, there's some there's something on the other side. There's some real potential change.
Talk to us a little bit more about what you mean by challenge versus traumatic, and how do you know if what you experienced is that might feel perhaps to you, because you've never had anything like it before, traumatic, when really it's quote unquote just challenging?
Yeah. I guess traumatic would be, you know, you feel like it's a mistake that, you know, like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Now I've collapsed more. I'm more, you know, fearful of, you know, I don't feel like I'm living more with more trust, openness, joy. It things, my life and experience is worse. I would say, okay, that's a traumatic experience. And that can happen, you know, because it can scare the heck out of people. A challenging experience, I think, is, and this, a lot of people have challenging experiences because these plants have some way, we don't understand the mechanics. We don't understand the mechanics of the brain well. We just don't, you know, we're theorizing here. But what it looks like is that they have some way of bringing some of these experiences or events or something to the surface. And sometimes you can kind of relive them. This has been my experience. I know many other veterans. So it's tough to relive hard things that's happened to us, but then you're able to like work with it. It's there. And then if you have the right tools, then you're able to develop kind of a new relationship with it so that it's not holding you back as much. And so for me, my, you know, experiences, I'm able to, you know, I feel like I was able to honor them in some ways and also let them go. And it's not like I forgot them. It's just, they're not like in my central nervous system showing up on a daily basis without my, you know, consent, I guess you could say. And that's, I think, what we want. But there was challenge in that, you know? And for some people that have really severe stuff, you know, it's going to be a period of time that you have to kind of be willing to work with these things, but there's a light at the end of the tunnel. It'll be, you know, you can kind of let these things go. They cannot be weighing you back. And then, I mean, epigenetics, if you look at that, you would have been laughed out of a university 20 years ago if you were talking about this stuff. And now you can see it in some of the studies that have been done, but we're all also carrying around stuff from our parents and our parents' parents. And so, you know, the deeper the trauma, sometimes the more times it needs to be let go, you know, but and through that effort, you know, we can let it go, and we can be lighter and more joyous and peaceful. It's just, it requires kind of some conscious effort on our part.
What's your advice to someone who's hearing this and says, okay, Neil, this is so helpful. It's really interesting. But it sounds like if I have a challenging experience, or even one that isn't challenging, that gives me some sort of new way of thinking about my situation, my habits, or separates me from some of the traumas or the background issues that may be causing me to be such an obsessive overworker, or need to be at the top of the ladder, or need to have acquisition, 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 but my job is so overwhelming, how am I even going to find time to do the work on this? Because, well, you know, one thing I will say, the guests over and over, and I assume you're going to say the same too, you kind of have, but not directly, which is, you know, you have the ceremony or the experience, then you have an integration afterwards, presumably, right? But then it still, over time, stays with you. At least that's what I've found. This isn't something that I just had the integration, I was integrated the next day and fine. To some extent, the changes in it have accelerated and compounded over time. If my job is so overwhelming, I can't think about anything except crunching the next set of numbers or presenting the next spreadsheet at a meeting, what do you tell folks like that?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, timing matters, you know, and there's some synchronicity that, you know, I think we're trying to kind of tune into. We want to be in sync with things. We don't want to go too fast or too slow, and we want to kind of do things at the right time. And so you should tune into that. And, you know, psychedelics aren't for people that don't want to do them or don't feel ready to do them. They're for people that want to make some change, and they're like, okay, this feels right and time's right. And we all go through these phases. I mean, I think if things are like really, really crazy in your life, you know, that's a phase that's probably going to change. And maybe it's the right time to do something like a kind of, you know, more dramatic intervention. Maybe it's not. No one can tell you that other than you. You'll know, you know what I mean? I think a more optimal experience, though, is to go do this in the right way, right context. And if you can, have some spaciousness around it. Because I think, you know, these experiences, there's kind of a physiological component. There's a spiritual component. There's a lot happening. We don't understand all the mechanisms, but what we want to, you know, more optimal experience is that you have more time for things to shift. So if you just have this experience and then you immediately go back to the kind of rat race life, it's likely that your body's going to kind of like go back to its old mode. You know, we're theorizing. Have we done like 20 year studies on this? No, but I'm telling you what I'm seeing and, you know, what I think some of the experts in the field agree is that the more spaciousness you can put around the experiences, the better, because in that spaciousness is how you allow for some shifts, you know? And, you know, I mean, these experiences are not about, to me, you know, immediately getting to some end state. And then you're like this being, this different, it's about learning a different way to live. You know, life continues to come at us, you know? And so it's more about developing that new perspective. And then for us, it's about helping people make actual habit changes, you know? I think that, you know, I'll just tell you what I've seen over the years is if you give someone one of these experiences, likely they'll go back home. And if you ask them, you know, months later or whatever, they'll tell you, oh, like they feel better. They're like, I just feel more peaceful. Stuff at work that used to drive me nuts, I'm just not that affected by it. I just surf it. You know, I notice that I'm not as irritable. I feel like I'm more just grateful for my life. I'm so lucky and I just feel that more often. And that's beautiful. We want that. What I think happens over time, though, if there's no habit change, is that that like sense of beauty and wonder and connectedness, because life continues to come at us and we will revert back to our old ways because there's like momentum there, is that that'll fall off. And so what I think we want to do to kind of extend this more aligned state of being after these experiences is teach people the ways of being, which is to me, meditation, time in nature. You got to look at your friend group and the people you're spending time with. You got to look at your work, and you're trying to kind of, you know, do things, you know, we want people to live differently. You know, you got to take better care of yourself if you want to feel better.
One of the things, by the way, that you mentioned that we haven't explicitly discussed on the show yet, but I definitely have found since engaging with psilocybin and choosing to do a lot of work related to the many shifts that occurred within me after and because of that journey, relates to the friend groups. I really did shift, not to use that word over and over again, but it's really the only accurate one, who I was associating with. A lot of people, it was clear, it was time to go. Not that they're bad people, not that I don't care about them, not that they're not worthy generally. They weren't right for who and what I needed to be. And that space that opened by shifting those relationships, there I go using that word again, opened the door for people who were able to be there for me in a different way, that I was able to show up differently with, and that furthered my path down the road that I needed to be.
Yeah. That's a huge part of it. It's our close friendships and relationships. And I mean, there's so many different little sayings, or everybody knows this. It's like, you are the company you keep. And And yeah, that should, I think if you're growing and evolving, then there should be some changes that happen over time. I think for me, you know, I have a lot, some amazing friends from all different chapters of my life. And then some friends have kind of, you know, fallen away. Like you said, I love them. No love lost. You know, are they, you know, life's pretty, it's crazy enough. So you have to be kind of selective with the folks that you're going to invest in and spend time with. And I think my friend group now is more people that are, you know, desiring some of the same things. They want to live a more connected existence, right? And they challenge me. It's less about kind of what I have or bells or whistles on my resume or whatever, and like who I am as a person. And they're trying to pull out the best in me, and I'm trying to do the best, you know, do that for them as well. And so yeah, these, you should be, you know, I think if you want your life to change, you need to be open to the idea that some of those relationships might change as well, because that's a huge function of kind of our existence.
It truly, truly is. There has been a lot that you've said, Neil, today that's really affected me and that will strike chords with those who are listening or watching. One takeaway that I have is that you really, sort of going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, need to be conscious of what you're surrounding yourself with from a relationship perspective, but also what those relationships are taking you into with regards to your work. And are those relationships and the situations that they put you into separating yourself from who and what you're meant to be and what ultimately brings you happiness? And tying that back to the original theme, if elitism, which, like you said, can include just being your best self, that's a wonderful thing, but if it is an instrument of separation and the company you keep are ultimately reinforcing that component of it, maybe it's time to consider, whether it's through meditation or a more, as you described it, drastic intervention, a life that can look different. If there is one final thing that you would like to say, whether it's a point that you want to underscore or something that you didn't get a chance to say so far, by all means, share.
Yeah, I think for me, to keep it simple, is that there's something, you know, there is something that is connecting us all. I actually, as a math physics kind of nerd, think if you go deep enough, you can see it. And a lot of these physicists saw it. But there's something that's very significant that's connecting all of us that you can kind of tune into and have a relationship with, and just be curious and just kind of feel into it. It could potentially change your life.
Speaking of life changes, let's close out your story arc. You're no longer in that rat race corporate environment. You did make those changes. Where did those changes take you? How can people find out about who you are now? Where can they go to just get even more Neil Markey than they've already had?
The ironic thing is, and I love what I'm doing now. I am so fascinated by it. And it's like a dream, and it's stressful, you know? You know, I laugh at myself. I'm like, oh, here you are again, Neil, in another like kind of stressful environment. But this one I believe in, and I think we're bringing something good into the world. So it's like, okay, it's fine. Maybe I just like need these stressful environments and I like the adventure. I run Beckley Retreats, which is part of the Beckley ecosystem, and really kind of all stems from this really amazing and iconic woman, Amanda Fielding, who led the Beckley Foundation, which is one of the world's leading research nonprofits for psychedelics. And so now, yeah, soldier to McKinsey to psychedelic retreat leader. We do programs in Jamaica and the Netherlands. And it's a real honor. Because it's so healthy for people if you do it in the right way. You know, it really can take people that are living a life that that is not really fulfilling them. It can help them kind of get pointed in the direction of a life that's just more in alignment. And then there's like trickle impacts, you know, there's ripple impacts too. Those folks, when they're living differently, they're just more pleasant. They're kinder. They're easier to be around. They're better fathers. They're better sons. They're just like, you know, they're just lighter. And I think we drastically need more of that in the world, you know?
Again, having worked in my fair share of those high stress environments, and I am sure many people listening to this or watching this have or are working in such environments, right? Just having people around you that you're working with who are easier to deal with, hey, that itself is something worth reaching for.
But also try and catch yourself when you're irritated with those people, like send them some love because they're trying to do their best. And a lot of times when someone is exhibiting these, you know, is a bit of a jerk or whatever, there's pain or there's fear there, you know, almost always.
Yeah. And I really want to thank you for reminding me of that, because that is easy to forget. I was never at my worst when I was being a jerk. It was because I was suffering. And perhaps as yet another little takeaway, remembering that those who are being difficult are coming from pain can help us be more of that compassionate person doing great stuff in the world, just like you, Neil.
Yeah. Well, and back to the topic of the kind of podcast, this elitist, you know, is like, you know, if we can just all kind of do the work so that we have that ability to, you know, be more responsive instead of reactive and see the sameness in everybody, you know, regardless of where they come from. You know, there's much more, we have much, much, much more in common than we do that divides us, you know. If we all just like work to see that, then we might have this world that we all think we need.
This was supposed to be a few sentences of last words, but you made it infinitely richer. Thank you.
God, sorry.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Neil. This was really special.
Thank you, my friend.
On the subject of connectedness and bringing things together, one thing that anyone who is listening to or watching this show can do is connect those that you care about with WebDelics. So if you like what we're doing, be sure to tell everyone that you know and who you care about WebDelics, its podcast, and our website, webdelics.com. That's WebDelics.com. Once you've done that, if you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe to our channel on YouTube, as well as to the audio versions of the podcast on your favorite audio platform. And we'd really feel connected with you if you left us a positive review on your favorite audio platform or a positive remark about this episode on YouTube. Once you've done that, go to our social media channels, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and connect with us there so you can get even more information. And then once you've managed to pull all of that off, and I know you will, then go right to our website again, sign up for our blog, and get all sorts of information that is curated, credible, and real right in your email box or on your computer screen. Finally, be sure to come back next time for another episode of the WebDelics Podcast.